This is FM 2.0 with the Don, Dean, Stormy, and the Grizz. Forever music.
All right, everyone. This is the Don and Dean, and we've got Trevor Rabin here. How you doing, Trevor?
Yeah. I'm great. Hi, Don. Hi, Dean. How you doing?
Doing great.
Fantastic. You know, this is one of those, what do you say, a dream interview? You're one of those people, because of your guitar playing, us both loving guitar.
I noticed the Rickenbacker, and is that a Gretsch on the wall?
It's actually an airline. It's not a Gretsch. It's one of the airline models.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, of course. And I saw in some of your videos, I think you've got a 330 hanging on your wall in a couple of those videos.
Yeah. Yes.
You've had that one for a while, haven't you? Because I've seen like old interviews where you had it on the wall and then recent ones.
Yeah, the 12 string, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a funny story with that. I don't know if you're aware of Chris Squire was famously late for anything and everything.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, at his memorial, the cliche joke was, we wish he would have been late for that, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
But right. There was one time we were doing the Talk album in my studio, and he was supposed to be here at, I think it was 2:30 or 3 o'clock, and at 7:45, this hand comes around the door, and he opens the door and comes in, and I see this hand, and there's this beautiful Rickenbacker, and I just hear peace offering. And I said, oh, man, you got it.
That's a hell of a problem. Well, I'll tell you the story on that one, because it's kind of it's good for me. It's tragic for the guy that sold it to me. So he listed it as an 89 Rickenbacker, and right. I needed to replace the nameplate on the headstock. And, you know, Rickenbacker, you can't buy them. You have to send it to them. They'll replace it. So I sent them the serial number. I said, it's an 89. They came back, said, no, it's a 69. I went, no, it's an 89. And they go, no, it's a 69.
Oh, wow.
The guy that sold it to me missed the difference between an I and a 1. And he had the wrong numeral in it, and the right numeral is. So I bought it as an 89. It turns out it's a 69.
Oh, man, that's a special guitar.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
69.
Hopefully he's not watching, because he'll kick himself.
Yeah.
Do you got like a force field around that thing? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Protect that. It's a...
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it's pretty special.
Well, Trevor, it's amazing to me. I mean, this kind of blew me away. I didn't realize this. This is your first solo album of vocal material in 34 years. Is that accurate?
Yeah, it's amazing, you know, because when I think about that, it just doesn't feel like 10 years, 5 years, because, right. You know, I did that album, and then I toured that album, and then we went and did more Yes stuff, another Yes album, and then the Talk album, and then I toured with on the Talk tour, left the band, started doing film scores. I thought if I could get into it, and it's like a brick wall most of the time, but I was very lucky. And I got into it, and within I'd done two or three scores, and I thought, yeah, I'm really enjoying this. If more happens, I'm going to do it. Or, you know, I'll just start writing and doing another album. And here I am in 2023, 53 or whatever it is, movies later. And I did one movie for Jerry Bruckheimer. It's one of my very first movies. And next thing, I did the next 12 Bruckheimer movies. And then the same thing happened with Disney and Warner. So 50-odd movies later, here I am. So the time has not gone slowly. It's just flashed by. I look back and I can still remember doing the Con Air score. So even though I've been writing bits and pieces on the way, and my house is like an alcoholic's home, it's instead of bottles, it's pieces of manuscript all over the place with ideas. I mean, my wife actually said to me, we went for dinner one night. Well, it happened many nights. We'd go for dinner and she'd be talking to me, romantic lighting and everything, and she'd be talking to me and she'd just stop talking and say, "You're not listening to me, are you?" And she'd give me a piece of paper and a pen. She knew what was going on, and that happened a lot. And so by the time I started the album for real, and I said to my agent, I can't take on anything until I finish this record, not even, you know, not even to help out with the three-bar theme of a jingle. I'm kind of done now. I've got to put my head into this. And I spent, I don't know, 18 months or, you know, with little breaks here and there and really got into the album. And I think what was good was due to there being this 34-year hiatus, when I got into it, I felt really fresh, you know, felt like the first album. It wasn't like, okay, you're doing an album and a tour and an album and a tour, and, you know, that's the procedure. And this was, I'm doing an album, and I had not signed any record deal, and I thought, I just want to do this without really any input from a record company or outside source. And I started, and I finished, and I just went to, when I was doing Anderson, Raven, Wakeman, the tour, it was a perfect storm, because that's what got my hands really moving again and my voice muscle working. So by the time I came to do the album, I was A, in good shape from that point of view, feeling really fresh because I hadn't done one for a long time. And Thomas, who's the guy from the record company, had come and asked to do an Anderson, Rabin, Wakeman album. But we were touring all the time, and it would have been a, you know, Yes was always a kind of, if I was to try and explain it, it was like a beached whale. When it was swimming, it was glorious, you know, it was fun and everything was good, but getting it in the ocean was a bloody hard thing to do. Yeah. So
what an analogy.
Was it
analogy? Yeah.
No, that's a great analogy.
I've got so many questions, but one of the things I'll share with you, the lot of comments that I've received when I shared your song is that it sounds like you haven't missed a beat, that a day hasn't gone by, and how fresh you sound. And it's specifically your vocals. I mean, they still sound absolutely incredible. And that's always one of the things I never felt like, you know, people talked enough about was, yeah, we talked about your guitar skills and your composition skills, but your vocals are incredible. You've got a range.
Oh, thanks so much, man. Yeah. You know, as I say, the tour, you know, singing on the tour was, and the harmonies, oh, excuse me. Tell me if I'm moving around too much.
No, you're fine.
The harmonies and the lead vocals I did on the tour kind of really, you know, helped the muscle along, and because I hadn't done it for so long, I just belted stuff out. I'm sure you hear, I mean, every album you guys must review or interview the artist must say, this is the best album I've ever done, and I enjoyed it so much, the best album I'm not going to say it's the best album I've ever done, because I think that's kind of arrogant. It's up to you guys to decide whether it's good or bad. So, but I certainly enjoyed doing it, and I really felt fresh, and my hands flowed. I felt like I had them in a lot of butter or something for a while. It just flowed, and everything happened in the right way. There were a couple of moments where I'd go to bed like I do on a movie where I haven't had the theme hasn't come to me yet, and with film the schedule's not that easy. It's okay, I've scheduled myself to come up with Nicolas Cage's theme by Monday, and now it's Sunday night and I haven't come up with anything. And there'd be a couple of times where I was doing a guitar part where that happened and it's not sounding right, and I go back the next day and do it and couldn't get it, and then I try another guitar, try a different amplifier or different unit, and outside of a couple of times where that happened, it flowed pretty well.
Where do you, I'm curious, so I think about songs, I'll juxtapose like Push, and then juxtapose that going all the way back to 90125 Changes. You have an ear for really intricate that's what I don't want to say time signatures or timing. I mean, the coordination between the instruments and the parts. Where does that come from? Were you like a fan of math rock or King Crimson or?
Well, I love math rock. I think it's really interesting, and the sounds they're getting these days is pretty amazing. But I was also into, you know, the early Dave Clark Five, where you had the, you know, obviously Take Five, mm-hmm. and that one song which is in 7/8, dunch 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 dunch. You know, and in film, I was always I wrote in 13/8 and 9/8 and 7/8, almost more than in 4/4, because it's, you know, especially with in film, if you need some tension, it definitely adds to it if you're using different time signatures. And then on a song like Push, when the chorus comes in, I remember I had changed the chorus, and I phoned Vinny Colaiuta, the drummer, and I said, Vinny, listen, this, it's changing. The chorus is going to be changing. You're going to have to redo that. And he said, no problem. And I just wrote out the bass line, which was the timing, which was in, it went from a 10/8, I think 10/8, 11/8 to 12/8, and then back 10/8, 11/8, 12/8. I think that's how it went. And he's so incredible with polyrhythms and also time signatures. I mean, he hears it like breakfast, you know, it's nothing to him. he just played. I said, yeah, makes total sense. Cause I thought I was going to say, well, yeah, the first, and he did it. And, so it was good to have a guy like that to work with. And, you know, he nails that stuff.
I was sharing
very,
with Don.
Very naturally, you know.
What's I was that? Sharing with Don before you came on years ago as in a band, and we were trying to work changes into it. And, there was a lot of arguing and cussing between myself, the keyboardist, and the drummer. That's not a song for the faint of heart.
Yeah, there's one part there which is a bit weird, because what is it? Is it in 10/8? I can't remember. But then the 4/4 guitar rhythm happens over that 10/8.
Yeah.
And yep. if it doesn't meet up in the right way,
it's a train wreck.
It's a train wreck. Yeah. And the only way of doing that is to feel it, and it's really weird to feel. But once you get into feeling it, and whenever you're feeling it, you're thinking, the drum's speeding up a little bit here, and you can tell everything.
Oh, man. I'm just lost in the whole changes part. Well, you know, talking about songs, since we got you here on your new album. Now, if you want, I'd like to play a clip of a song.
Please
now
do.
I could take it out if you're like, I don't want my new music to be heard until after the album's out. I'll just take this part out.
Did we lose him?
Oh, did we? Oh, we did.
Well, there's our answer.
Hey,
sorry, something happened. I don't know what I did.
Yeah. What I was saying was, I wanted to talk about your new album, Rio.
Yes.
And other tracks on it too. You know, Push is out, getting a great response. If you don't mind, can I play other clips of songs for you? Now, I could edit them out if you don't want them to be heard until after October.
I mean, if it's just a clip, I'm sure. It's funny. My sister posted something. I sent her something, and she posted it like months ago, and the record company were kind of like, you can't do that. And it's like, shit, sorry, my mistake.
No,
so, but I'm sure it's fine. I mean, you know, we can check.
I can just edit it out until that. But it's just for us to hear it.
Yes.
It helps with the conversation. There's right. One song that blew me away when I was listening to your album. Since we're talking about time signatures, we're talking about genre crossover. I want to pull
yeah,
up.
Yeah, that Goodbye, was fun.
The song Goodbye.
Right, right.
Oh my God. All right. I'm going to hit mute on you both here because I don't want it to echo out. I'm going to play this clip of a song here for us. This is Goodbye. Right here. Should play. Come on. Hear that? Now watch this. Let me go to 203. if it lets me. Yeah, right here. Listen to this. Let me just make sure. Wait, let me go back to you guys here. Are you able to hear it?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, I'm getting to the part. Watch this. I can't wait. Here we go. Listen to this, everyone. Right here. That's just like, I got goosebumps because it's so phenomenal. Let me get you off mute here, bring you back. Trevor, that's just amazing, man. You go into this like Southern rock banjo type finger picking, boom, into like a Yes progressive chorus.
Back, you know, it's
it's just amazing.
Well, thank you so much. It's something I've always loved. You know, whenever playing in Nashville, I would go and check out all the bands playing around. They're such phenomenal players. And I've always been, you know, when I was doing session work in South Africa, I was 18 or whatever. This country is very huge in South Africa, and local artists and obviously American artists. And Anne Murray was Canadian. But I used to have to play all this, you know, this was kind of some of what's needed. I mean, it wasn't as kind of challenging as that solo, but there was a lot of stuff with the bends, you know, and sometimes dual bends. And what's used a lot with that is a thing called a B-bender. So that particular track, I'm using a B-bender, and it's a Telecaster B-bender. And it was. I just thought I really want to integrate some of that stuff, which I love, and playing banjo. And there's mandolin on the album as well. But yeah, banjo on that track, and I just love doing it. So having some guitar, chicken picking guitar, was really important.
You know, like this back in the 80s, Xanadu soundtrack, John Farrar produced that. And
I was a great producer.
Well, that when they do that big band thing with Olivia Newton-John, forget about tonight, and then the Tubes come in and do their old Take It Back. That's what that reminded me of. It was like crossing those two things, and that's what made it beautiful.
I know exactly the part you mean.
Yes.
What's interesting for me on that, if like, Don, if you and I were just sitting at the kitchen table and you were to pull up this song and go, hey, check this out. I'm not kidding. My first reaction would have been, you know who that makes me think of? Trevor Rabin.
Oh, wow. Well, that's an amazing compliment.
That is amazing.
It really would have, because it's like I hear that's like, which here's a question I've wanted to ask for some time. And this does go back into old history. So as I understand, 90125. That was actually your album. That started off as more of your personal project. It was going to be called Cinema.
Right.
Real quick side note, it's funny. Don and I were actually talking with Jeff Pilson the other day, which I'd learned that he had a band called Cinema. And one of my questions was, so were you the Cinema that created conflict for Trevor's project? And he goes, yeah. But
oh, wow. I remember that vividly.
Yeah. So my question is, so I consider myself a huge Yes fan. The era that you brought in was uniquely you, and it was great. Your style is so awesome. Thank so when people refer to your style and they say, well, this is very Yes-ish, I look at it and go, well, that's Trevor Rabin. If you had to do all over again, would you have allowed that to be a Yes album, or would you have rather that had been a You album?
Well, it was intended to be a U album until David Geffen's company just dropped me like a ton of bricks. It was quite amazing. I was lying at the pool at the little house in Van Nuys, and the phone rang and I picked it up, and it was early Monday morning, and not that early because, you know, one has to work Sunday night. And it's, I think it was guy Ed Rosenblatt, who was the head of finance at Geffen. Really nice guy. We'd been for dinner with him a couple of times at his house. And he just phoned to say, look, just want to let you know, this development deal, we've decided not to go ahead. So as of today, you're dropped. And it was nice speaking to you, and put the phone down. It's like, okay, so now all my income is cut off. I've just spent an absolute fortune, the little I had, on a studio, and I have a mortgage. So what do I do now? So I frantically started sending tapes out. And that, basically, it was 90125. And, and then met up with Chris and Alan through Atlantic, and that's how it happened. And we called it Cinema, and I was really disappointed when the name became a problem. And then it was, well, let's call it Yes. And I thought, yeah, but it's got nothing to do with the old Yes, you know, let's do something new. And there was a real discussion about it, but the Atlantic were really hot to call it Yes because they saw money. And that's how eventually we lost the battle, and that was it.
But it is your fingerprint. I mean, I can hear a song and go, well, that sounds like Steve Howe. And I can hear a song and go, well, that sounds like Trevor Rabin. I mean, it's you.
Yeah. I must give props to Chris, because Chris and I were like, really like brothers. And I mean, beyond the usual cliche, oh, he's like a brother.
Chris Squire you're talking about?
Chris Squire, yeah.
Yeah.
We were very, very close. And he actually said to me, he said, look, I know this is like our new project, but calling it Yes isn't going to change that and all this stuff. On the road, there's certain things we're going to have to play from the old catalog. Because the album's done well, we must do the whole album, so it'll take a huge part of the show. But we've got to do Roundabout and Seen All Good People and a couple of things. But you do it any way you want. Don't feel like you've got to emulate any of the parts on the original. Just do your thing. And as far as other songs we might have to do, as far as, you know, time, just filling up a little more, you choose them. So there was a real kind of he really had a compassion as to how I should be feeling.
Wow.
And so the shows became, you know, what was good about that is the new stuff became a lot more cohesive with the old stuff, because there was different arrangements and different ways of playing them, I guess.
Wow.
And the Strat sounds real different to the 335.
Yes. Yes. And I'm a big fan of the Strat. Big fan.
Yes. Yes.
Love a me single too. Coil.
Before I switch back to the album, that was a great. Thanks for elaborating on that. I just have to say that of all the songs, Yes, Hold On is my favorite song. That song means so much to me. I remember when I got the tape. I mean, Owner of a Lonely Heart was track one, but when we got to Hold On, and just the inspiration, you know, you're a teenager and you're right. Listening to this song, and it affected me as a teenager so much. That was like my feeling good about the day. This is going to make me live another day and be great as a teenager. Hold On was that song to me.
Oh, well, that's so great to hear.
Yeah.
That's really great to hear. And, you know, that song was one of, I think, to a man, it was one of the favorites on tour. We really loved playing it.
Well, you know, I think, Dean, you and I were talking about the harmony parts, right? There's notes that are there's, Dean, you were saying about the notes, right? Going up.
Yeah, you sit in the same register when you need to as John Anderson did.
Yeah, no, I'm doing all those high harmonies, and it hurts. I'm coughing thinking about it.
I've been actually working, just side note, I've been doing a lot of posts talking about three-part harmony, talking about the importance of high harmony and how that really differentiates the band. And I spent a lot of time talking with Graham Goble from Little River Band because he was their high harmony. And it really is a special thing that I feel like over the 80s, 90s, it's gotten lost. Not enough bands really take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's weird that, I mean, when they're good, they, you know, when it works, it's so fantastic. Yeah. You know, it creates such a great blanket or, and sometimes a piercing armament.
Yeah.
Just depends which way you approach it.
Don, I know I deviated from where you were going.
Oh, no. This is great. Well, another track you have on here, I mean, look, yeah. Every track, I was just blown away when I was listening to your album. So, track 7, Tumbleweed.
Yeah.
I wanted to play the intro to this. Again, I'm going to hit mute on you both so it doesn't echo. I just want you to hear this so we can talk about it. This intro. So, you know, I take it an album old school, track 1 of the end. So it starts with Big Mistakes and Push. Oklahoma is an amazing song. Holy cow, I got notes on that. But this Tumbleweed, I want you to hear this. Just this intro. This
walking into the twilight, roaming through the dark clouds, watching shadows move faintly. Silence in your eyes, tender. If I give my love to you, would you help me find my way to your warm home? Life is a fleeting.
And then it swoons in. I'm going to come back. And then there was one more note. Then I want to talk about this more. So another note I had on that was the outro to this. I'm going to go to the outro at 3:05. This just knocked my socks off. You know, I'm listening to a whole album and I get to this and I had to listen to it a few times. So the tie-in is, it starts with this electronic harmonized vocal, and then the guitar does that part, essentially on the outro, just simply a guitar. That whole beginning, Trevor, reminds me of taking the Beach Boys and ELO and putting that together in there. That was just, that blew my mind when I was listening to it.
Well, you know, one of my rules for myself, which is really important, is not to use any crutches or assists when doing vocals. In other words, tuning them and stuff. So doing so many vocals, you know, there were times where, you know, oh, that's a little out of tune. Well, I wouldn't fix it. I'd re-sing it. So it took a while, but the idea was always to do the intro with vocals which have extended chords, jazz chords, but with a very simple lyrical thing, and then to bookend it at the end with the exact part on a jazz guitar, which was done on, I think, my 400 Gibson, which sounds...
It felt like George Benson was in the room.
It's good. It's definitely got that big, warm body sound.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right. No, wow. it's
It's gorgeous.
It was an interesting one to do, that's for sure.
Well, that's the thing about you. Like, this album is not a, okay, here's 12 tracks I put together. And you can tell there was a lot of thought. I mean, you took a hiatus and just those two tracks alone, and that's deep into the album. That's like six and seven and eight.
Right.
Like, Push is very, very what we're used to. The big guitar, the that's you. That's like your signature Push. And then you get down here and you can see all these other influences going on in there. And that's what's, it's like a beautiful recipe of ingredients.
Yeah, I'm such a huge fan of the harmony thing, as we talked about earlier. It's, I mean, once you get into it, you can go down a rabbit hole. It's, you know, especially with using extended chords, and where a chord maybe should be the dominant, you do it with a flat five or, you know, 13 or something. It's just, there's just so many options and variations.
Were you a student of music? Like, can you read music? I mean, I can't read.
Yeah.
I'm not good at reading music. So you sound so astute, like you're a student of music. That's what it sounds
well,
like.
You know, my father was the first violinist, and he conducted really well, but he was the first chair of the Johannesburg Symphony Orchestra for 15 years.
Oh.
And so when I was 5 years old, and the three of us, a brother and a sister, every kid from about that age starts piano, like it or not, and, you know, half an hour before school, and then after school, before you go out and play, you got to do another. You have to do an hour of sight reading, scales, and whatever else there might have been. And I had lessons twice a week, not to mention my dad would hover over me most of the time. And my mom's a fantastic classical pianist. I mean, like, Chopin was like nothing to her, you know. So I did grow up with DNA.
You have good music DNA then.
Yeah. I think I could read music before English, so that didn't hurt.
Wow. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Wow. So growing up the child of a concert master is, you had a lot of expectations on you.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but my dad, as I said to you, when I was about 17, 18, I started doing sessions, and I got lucky with it. So I was literally doing sessions nonstop. It was just a full-time thing, but I had a band that we played at night, so I was just exhausted all the time. But, you know, at that age, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And so I said to my dad, look, I want to be a conductor at some point, so it's time. So he got me this incredible... a friend of his, Walter Mone, who was the dean at the University of Johannesburg, and I studied privately with him. It had to be because I just didn't have any time to do it any other way. And he took me through, you know, conducting, arrangements, orchestration, formal analysis, you know, and all that stuff in no time. And I'm a dreadful student, so it was definitely not because of me. It was because he was such an inspiring teacher. And then near the end of that, where I was feeling pretty confident and I was already, because of my sessions, that had led me to doing string arrangements or brass arrangements for different productions, records and things. And I was really getting into it. And I said, yeah, Dad, I really want to be a conductor. And he called me, because he was also a lawyer, and he called me into his office and he said, look, I think we need to talk. And I said, what's wrong? He said, look, with the way things are going for you with sessions and with, you know, the record company wanting to record the album, I think you should put aside the expectation of being a conductor, because I don't think you understand the incredible repertoire you have to have inside you in order to even start that. And he said, I think you're going to do just fine with rock and roll and utilize all this stuff for that. And I thought, well, I'm quite generally I'm a procrastinator, so that works pretty well. So I said, okay.
And interestingly, you end up writing scores, which I assume do you conduct when you're in the studio with the
orchestra? Yeah.
Yes, and I conducted everything I did in Johannesburg, and even with Yes, there were a couple of things. A song called "Love Will Find a Way." There's a little octet in the beginning, which
that's one of my favorite songs.
Great. Well, the string thing in the beginning is one I conducted in the studio, and then with film, it's, you know, there's so much to do in talking to the director while it's going down. Early on, I just thought, you know what. I'm just going to have a guy in there. It's, you know, conducting doesn't really mean too much on scores because it's all done to click track. And I mean, obviously it's an important aspect, but nothing like if you're doing 1812 or you know, Schoenberg's works. sorry, we have construction going on here. So there's dust everywhere. Dust everywhere. Anyway, yeah, so with most of the scores, we would hire a conductor to come and do it so I could be nagged by the director.
Do you, just out of curiosity, so do you have a composer that you are really attached to? My daughter's a cellist, so naturally she grew up being trained around Bach. That period. Me, love the late Romantic Impressionist, big fan of Debussy, Satie, Fourier.
Oh, absolutely. Rachmaninoff.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you drawn towards?
I love the Eastern guys, Prokofiev and even the more commercial guys like Tchaikovsky. I mean, not all, but I love it. And then on the more melodic side, Elgar is just tremendous, you know, Nimrod and stuff like that. And then a guy who's pretty much atonal, but there's one, I mean, there's a lot of stuff, but Schoenberg, Arnold Schoenberg did a piece called Verklärt Enough. He wrote it for a sextet, but the one to listen to is the full string section. It's chilling.
It is.
Nice.
I feel like I should talk softer now, like we're going classical. Here we are.
Well, we can talk Wagner, then you can get loud and powerful.
NPR.
Oh, there you go.
We're on NPR now. Right. Well, again, Trevor, this new record, everyone should be excited about it. Push. Since you're promoting Push, I was going to play a clip of that too.
Cool.
The segment at 2:17. And we'll know why I picked that here in a second. So Push again is out. Rio will be coming out in late October, like the third week of October. So you got to wait for that. But you can get Big Mistakes and you can get Push. So again, I mentioned that, what did I say my note was here? It is at 2:17. So let's go to 2:17 of Push. It's right here. This is phenomenal. I really hope you're going to tour or something, because let me get you back on here. I just see just that song alone, a light show beyond anything.
Well, for anybody that's watching that are young developing musicians, well, I love it. I spend a lot of time talking about the importance of creating tension and resolution in music. And that's what you do so well. I mean, you'll create a moment of tension, and then you'll go into this resolution that makes you feel like you're just floating. And yeah.
God, thank you.
So it's incredible.
Very much. You know, that reminds me, that's something I don't want to get into it. Like Steve Hackett did that a few times too, in old Genesis, where he'd bring it all over the place and then take it there. And that's exactly that journey.
Yeah. I love Steve. He's a wonderful guy.
Yes. Well, you, as Dean just said, wow, that just sailed it off. It's beautiful.
Thank you. Thanks.
Yeah. So, wow. So it's coming out October 23rd, I believe. I think that's what it was.
I think it's actually October 6th. I'm seeing here.
Oh, you're right.
Wow. October 6th is a big day. There's some great albums coming out that day.
Oops.
No. I think it's great because I've been using it to talk up and draw a lot of attention. So,
yes. Many thanks.
And I was so excited to see your album coming out because I like talking about you. I do it a lot on Vinyl, yes, Rewind, and D-Tracks.
And TikTok,
I do, yes.
Real quick, too, Rio is actually named after your granddaughter, right?
Yeah, my little angel. It's her second birthday in a couple of weeks, so she's not aware of it yet, but she will be.
One day,
when I'm long gone, she'll be saying, "It's my grandpa."
Grandpa named us after me.
Right.
Oh, that's all. Of course, her voice will be a lot deeper than that.
Yeah, exactly.
By then. Because you're going to live a long time, Trevor. Don't check out on us yet.
I hope to do some more before I hit it.
Please. Anything else, Dean?
No, this has been great. I appreciate it.
Yeah, this has been fantastic. Again, everyone, go out and get Rio on October 6th. Trevor, thank you for taking time out of your life to spend time with us.
Guys, it's such a pleasure talking to you guys. Thank you so much, and thanks for the kind words. Much appreciated.
Absolutely. Thank you, Trevor.
All right, man.
Have a great night.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye, Trevor.